Today is Monday, July 17th. We're going to be working on more brain, spinal cord, and spinal nerve information today. Okay, so last Wednesday after the test, I know brains are not necessarily focused after a test. It's hard to keep that new material straight. So I'd like to go back and hit the spinal cord and spinal nerve cross-section information. And this comes from the bottom of 104, the top of 105, and there's a picture on the bottom of that page. To start off with, in this particular picture, we are simply looking at the central nervous system. We know the brain and spinal cord make up the central nervous system. And this spinal cord cross-section reveals the inner gray matter and the surrounding white matter. So what is gray matter? Why do we call it gray? Not myelinated. Good. So the white matter being white is myelinated. What does it mean to be myelinated? That's it. It's got a myelin sheath which wraps and covers those neurons. We have saltatory propagation. So which type of matter here would have a faster nerve impulse transmission? White matter, good. Okay, so do we call parts of a white matter columns or horns? Columns, good. And of course the gray matter is referred to as those horns. So we're missing our landmark. In order to see our landmark, we actually need to see this dorsal root ganglion. So we know that the dorsal root ganglion is a collection of neurons bringing information into the spinal cord. That's what I need to see. Since it is the dorsal root ganglion, is it on the posterior or anterior side? Posterior, good. So now I've got my bearing straight, I've got myself oriented. Let's start back here on this backside. What is the name of this region of white matter? Dorsal columns, good. And of course, on each side we have a region of white matter known as? Lateral columns, good. And down here at the front side, these portions are called? Ventral columns, good. So that takes care of our three regions of white matter. The portions of gray matter are called horns. So let's first hit this set of horns toward the back side. These horns are called dorsal horns. And what types of neurons do they house?
Interneurons.
Interneurons, good. And so what is the function of an interneuron? Good. It's a go-between, it talks between incoming sensory and outgoing motor. So yeah, that's an important part of the spinal cord because it plays the role of a middleman. Interneurons talk between sensory and motor neurons. This portion here that kind of bumps out on the side is called our lateral horn of gray matter, and it houses a specific type of neuron. What type is found here? Like right here and right there. What type of neuron is housed there? Motor neurons, good. Is it a involuntary autonomic motor neuron or a voluntary somatic motor neuron? Involuntary, good. So what kinds of events are involuntary? That's right, smooth muscles, not skeletal muscles.
Yeah.
Okay, we've got things like involuntary events that include breathing and heart rate and blood vessel diameter, things of that sort. So we're talking about involuntary automatic events being housed and initiated here at that lateral horn. Down at the bottom here, we have a ventral horn of gray matter. This is once again a motor neuron that's housed there. And what type of motor neuron? Voluntary, good. So what kind of muscles are controlled through those voluntary horns? Skeletal, good. So conscious movement of skeletal muscle, good. All right, so let's kind of tie this picture together with the spinal nerve. The spinal nerve is technically part of your peripheral nervous system. We notice that the spinal nerve branches into two roots. The root on the back is called what? Dorsal root, good. Does it carry sensory information or motor information?
Sensory.
Sensory, good. Does sensory information come into your spinal cord or go away from your spinal cord?
Go into.
Good. So this is a route of neurons coming into the dorsal horn. The dorsal horn makes decisions and then sends it back out by way of this ventral root. So let me give you an example of how this works. You ever lay your hand on something hot like a stove or a toaster oven? Okay. So before you even have a time to process and think it, your hand has jerked away and moved away from that source of potential pain. So when you put your hand on a hot stove, which root brings that painful hot temperature into your spinal cord?
Dorsal
root. Good. So the dorsal root brings the information here to your dorsal horn of the gray matter. What types of neurons are housed there? Interneurons. Good. And interneurons receive that sensory information that says, ouch, this was hot and painful. The interneurons say to one of these two horns, move your hand. So which one of these controls skeletal muscle? The ventral, yes. So the ventral horn of that gray matter controls skeletal muscle. Out we come through this ventral root. What does this message say to your hand? Pull your hand away. Yeah, move that hand. So this is how the spinal cord operates. If you've ever done something like this, like leaned your hand on a hot stove or onto a hot toaster oven, you've jerked your hand away before you even have time to process and think about what happened. When you pull your hand away, you probably look and realize you just did something silly. And about that time, the pain information has now reached your brain. So let's trace it up to the brain. So here comes that hot information in through your dorsal root. It hits these interneurons here. Those interneurons are the middleman that play a role between sensory and motor. Okay, so if we're going to take this information to your brain, we now travel across this gray commissure. What does that gray commissure do for us? Good. It's a contralateral control. It sends information from one side of the spinal cord to the other side. And the reason we're doing this is we're coming over here to hit this lateral column of the white matter. This lateral column has sensory neurons that travel up towards your brain. So when we travel up towards your brain, we eventually hit a portion of your brain that processes pain and temperature information. And so if you've ever laid your hand on a hot stove and you've jerked your hand away, you go, oh man, that's gonna hurt. And a split second later, the pain finally hits. Ever done this?
Yeah.
So why the delay in the pain? It hadn't made it anywhere yet. So where is it traveling right now before that pain hits? It's in the columns. So it's coming all the way up your spinal cord. Even though it's myelinated, it is still a long way to go. And so finally, we get to the point in your brain where we can interpret that sensation you just felt as pain. So that's why there's a split-second delay in getting that information processed. Eventually, the information comes back down. You might come back across that gray commissure. And at this point, your brain may have said, ooh, put that under cold water or put some ice on that burn. And we now have more motor control that can come out that ventral root of the spinal nerve.
What keeps you from feeling pain?
Probably other things like endorphins or prostaglandins that interfere with that pain relay process. There's something that must block the reception of the transmission to the brain, so we either ignore it or we don't sense it in the first place. Too bad you can't turn that on when you need it. Okay, how you doing with spinal cord and spinal nerve cross-section? Getting there? Okay. Have you guys done some lab yet? Not yet?
Mm-hmm.
Getting to it. Maybe you'll get there today and tomorrow. Okay. Okay. So what I'd like to do is take you into the middle of page 105. We need to talk a little more specifically about the white matter. That's about dead center of page 105. So white matter is myelinated. What does that mean? Myelin sheath, good. And it tells us what information about the speed of the impulse?
Faster.
Faster, good. And if I told you that white matter contains sensory and motor neurons, where do you think this information is going to and from? Good. From the spinal cord to the brain, and then from the brain back down the spinal cord. Good. So the gray matter is involved in processing information from the spinal nerves in and back out of the spinal cord, but this white matter is actually going to process information to and from the brain. So in the white matter, we have special regions of ascending tracts and descending tracts. What do ascending tracts carry, sensory or motor?
Sensory.
Sensory, good. You don't have to memorize this picture. I thought it would be cool to show you, though. In blue, what you have is all these ascending tracts, and each one is for a specific part of your body. So it's really cool because you can say, okay, I've got problems conducting information from this region, so we can say this must be the particular portion that's damaged. The red portion is, in fact, a descending tract. What do descending tracts house?
Motor.
Good. So where is motor information going? Good. From the brain down the spinal cord. So kind of cool that we can look at this and see where information is specifically traveling. The up pathways or ascending pathways are blue, and of course the red ones are the descending pathways. So when we think about how all this works, let's go back to your previous picture. If you take and put your hand on a hot stove, let's get this one here. That information comes in by way of your dorsal root through sensory nerves. It comes to your interneuron, and then if you are, you know, laying your hand on something that potentially could burn you, you automatically jerk your hand away through a reflex, and that reflex comes right back out your ventral root, right through this way, so that ventral horn to the ventral root, and then you reflex away from that painful stimulus. At the very same time, though, you're going to have that information hop over through this gray commissure and hit the appropriate column to go up to your brain. So the lateral columns are like elevators. They take information up to your brain for processing, and then they receive the sensory information and send that info back down your spinal cord. So I think of them as elevators in the ascending columns and in the descending columns. Okay, so on your worksheet, you'll notice there's a couple of places that we're heading. There is a spinothalamic tract, and there is a spinocerebellar pathway. Let's take a look at those. And that's right in the middle of page 105. So under ascending tracts, you'll notice spinothalamic tracts and spinocerebellar tracts. Spino means spinal cord, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, let's take the first one there, spinothalamic. Thalamic means thalamus. The thalamus is a piece of your brain that processes pain and temperature information. And in this picture, it looks like a big red eye. So the thalamus is a really interesting part of your brain. We think of it as a relay station. So incoming sensory information, such as pain or temperature from burning your hand on a hot stove, comes up through the thalamus. And the thalamus will then map that to the appropriate portion of your brain. If your thalamus isn't working, then that information is not relayed out to the appropriate part of your brain. Interesting stuff about your thalamus, it's also the part of your brain that keeps you awake and conscious. So people that are losing consciousness and going to sleep then, of course, have the thalamus no longer relaying sensory information. So it's a really cool part of your brain. It's the one that's going to act to relay out all this stuff to the appropriate regions. So pain and temperature info comes to your thalamus. Your thalamus then routes that information to the right part of your brain. All right, so let's go back to our big picture here. If you've put your right hand on the stove, and I'm making a point here about it being my right hand, if I lay my right hand on the stove, you'll notice we come in through the dorsal root, which houses sensory nerves. We travel to that dorsal horn of the gray matter. The dorsal horn carries what kinds of neurons? And their job is to? Yeah, talk between sensory and motor. You're right, they're relaying information. And because we're going to tell your brain, we're going to come across that gray commissure right there. We're going to hit the appropriate lateral column, and we're going to head up in the elevators We're heading up in an ascending track. And you notice right there we are on the left hemisphere of the brain. This is a great example of contralateral control. So since this was pain information, we stopped through this thalamus. What did the thalamus do with that information? That's right, relays pain to the appropriate part of the brain. And so it looks like if you put your hand there, it actually came to that area that your hand was located. And so there's a part of your brain tissue that's mapped to your hand. So that's why it takes a little bit longer for you to actually feel the pain when you lay your hand on a hot stove. You've already moved your hand away using a reflex, but to sense that pain, this is the route that we have to take. And for you to say, oh man, I'm going to put that under some cold water to help, you have to come back down through a set of descending tracks, which is going to take, you know, another split second to travel. So, go ahead.
Doesn't happen also when, like, you ever seen the, you know, the baby get shots, you know? When the baby doesn't cry right away, they've already finished the administration of the shot, band-aid, and it goes up.
Yeah, and it's probably that serum spreading out into the muscle tissue, and you're right, it takes that time to get to the brain. Yeah. Okay, so spinocerebellar pathway is a different pathway. You'll notice the spinal portion is familiar. That means spinal cord. But cerebellum is a piece of your brain tissue back here at the back part of your brain. This piece back here is one that deals with motor control. You know, as far as animals go, we have a fairly small cerebellum. Animals that need good motor control, like birds, have a much bigger cerebellum than us. So we are going to now take a pathway up here to this cerebellum, and you'll notice in your paper there, this is going to be joint and muscle information that's traveling your spinocerebellar pathway. Okay, so over here on the right, you know, we've got a pathway that looks really similar. We're going to head up another ascending track, but this one's going to end up here in our cerebellum. So if you're thinking about where your joints and your muscles are in space, you can actually close your eyes, maneuver through this room and out into the hallway pretty well without having any visual input of where your body is in space. That is the role of the spinocerebellar pathway. So if we are sleepy, if we're drunk, if we're medicated or whatever, then that can interfere with proprioceptors in those muscles and joints, and then that's how we don't end up walking quite straight. So proprioceptors detect joint and muscle situations in space.
Well, pictures like this be on the
top. No, that's just to kind of help us see the link between all that stuff together. Okay, so let's repeat. We've got gray matter that conducts information in from the spinal nerve, back out of spinal nerve, and then we've got various regions of white matter that behave as ascending or descending tracks. So what do ascending tracks carry to the brain? What type of information? Good. And descending tracks carry?
Motor.
Good. If we're talking about a specific pathway that has to do with pain or temperature information, what type of ascending track are we in?
Spinothalamic.
Good. And we're heading to what part of your brain?
Thalamus.
Good. And of course, the thalamus is going to be relaying that information. It's kind of a relay station for things like pain and temperature info. If we head up a spinocerebellar pathway heading to the cerebellum, what must have been the nature of that information?
Joint
and muscles, good, good. So I'd like to kind of take you on a detour for just a moment and tell you about this thing called phantom limb pain. People who have amputations are often plagued with this phantom limb pain where they feel sensations in that missing limb. Unfortunately, you can't scratch a missing limb if it itches, and you can't stop it from hurting if it's in pain. So they've got this really cool low-tech treatment that involves no medication. It simply involves placing the patient in front of a set of mirrors. So you'll notice in this picture, this man's normal leg is hidden from his view. He's got a dividing board here, and the amputated leg is what he's looking at, and he's going to use this mirror right here to look at that leg. They think that by using the mirror, we can reroute the brain messages because what he's getting is phantom limb pain, maybe itching, maybe painful sensations in that amputated leg. So over time and over physical therapy treatment, his brain will eventually be rewired, that's a word, right? Rewired. And that way he will no longer receive information from the spinothalamic pathway. So what does that spinothalamic pathway conduct?
Pain
and temperature, right. So you were born with that spinothalamic pathway built into your spinal cord, whether or not you've actually got arms or legs. You can be born with no arms, no legs, and still be routing pain or temperature information from arms and legs that don't actually exist. So it's kind of interesting that the body is built for arms and legs even if they never form. So you can imagine how traumatic it is for the body to no longer have a body part but still want to send information to the brain. So cool, very low tech, usually a successful way to route and reroute those nerve wirings in the brain. Related to this, down at the bottom of your page is something called referred pain. We have a lot of crisscrossing in our nerves. It's a backup plan so that in case we happen to have, you know, damage to one pathway, we have another pathway that we can follow. So let's talk about heart attack pain. Besides crushing pain in the chest, what are some other symptoms of heart attack pain?
Left arm
pain.
Jaw
pain. So where's the heart situated? Center of the chest. So how in the world would someone with pain supposed to be in the center of the chest end up being out the left arm and the left jaw?
Referred
pain, exactly. So it's the way the nerves crisscross and send information to your brain that you perceive there to be pain in those locations, when in fact that's not where the pain is coming from. So the pain is being referred to this other area. So we now know to assume that if you have left arm pain, you're probably having heart attack symptoms. A couple of other interesting ones. The gallbladder is sitting on your liver on the right side here in your abdominopelvic cavity. And you'll notice that gallbladder pain may be felt up here in the right shoulder. How crazy is that, right? Nobody's gallbladder is up here on the deltoid. So again, another case of referred pain. Kidney pain is crazy. Look at this, from the waist down to the thighs. That's where kidney pain radiates and is felt as referred pain. So these strange pain symptoms are actually a sign of crisscrossings in those ascending tracts. And again, this is a spinothalamic pathway that's conducting these sensations of pain to the brain. All right, so that should wrap it for page 105. How about questions there? I love a good rerun. The top of page 106 is a rerun. So you'll notice up there some familiar terms. We've talked about epimysium, but you notice this time it's called epineurium. We've got perineurium, which is the same wrapping as perimysium. And endoneurium, which wraps the nerve, is the same as endomysium. Good. Let's take a look at your picture there. The top left arrow is which of those three wrappings?
Epineurium.
Good. The bottom left wrapping covers a fascicle. It's called?
Perineurium.
Good. And on the right-hand side, that wrapping is around an individual nerve cell called a?
Endoneurium.
You got it. Endoneurium. Good. The very bottom of your page, I just want to point out that groups of nerves have special names. This is extremely helpful because when you see the word tract, tract says I am inside the central nervous system. You've heard of optic tracts, olfactory tracts. When you hear the word tracts, it's simply a group of neurons. But by using the word tract, you're telling us, hey, this is inside the central nervous system. It's kind of like saying this is inside the city limits versus being in the peripheral nervous system or outside the city limits. Let's talk about some other helpful terms. The word nerve also implies something. It implies that we're in the peripheral nervous system, as does the word ganglion. So if we talk about an optic nerve as opposed to an optic tract, the tract is in the central nervous system while the nerve is in the peripheral nervous system. We now know the dorsal root ganglion has a great built-in clue. Ganglion implies we're in which system?
PNS,
yeah. So use those as great helpful clues. Tracts are in the brain or the spinal cord, such as ascending tracts or descending tracts, while the words nerve and ganglion refer to the peripheral nervous system. Okay, and the bottom part there, that's probably just a review. We've talked about afferent, efferent. Mixed nerves are the spinal nerves, all 31 pairs of them, because they contain both sensory and motor. Do y'all have any questions so far? Okay. On the top of page 107, we're going to talk about two terms here. We're going to talk about ramus on this page. We'll talk about the word plexus on the next page. So when you think about these spinal cord cross-section pictures we've been looking at, we've typically stopped the picture right about here where the two roots come together and form a spinal nerve. Now we're going to take it just a little bit further. We're going to take it out here to look at these rami, and these rami are branches of the spinal nerves. So if you think about the spinal cord, there are 31 pairs of spinal nerves that emerge on either side. So from neck all the way down to the lumbar region, we've got spinal nerves branching off left and right. They not only go their separate ways, but they crisscross and branch with their neighbors. So in this picture, I don't think they do it justice. Let's just kind of take a look. If this was your spinal cord running down like this, you have a ventral root, you have a dorsal root, they come together there as the spinal nerve. As soon as they come together as the spinal nerve, then they start branching off into rami. This piece here is going to be ventral, and it's going to travel around to the front side of your body. So it may wrap around and serve your rectus abdominis muscle, it may innervate items inside your abdominopelvic cavity, but nonetheless, this ramus is going to be traveling to the front side of your body. This piece here is going to be called a dorsal ramus. Where does it go? The back, yeah. So it may serve your latissimus dorsi muscle. It may serve blood vessels, whatever the case may be. It's heading to the back side. Okay. So that looks clean, right? It looks like a pretty clean pathway for us to follow. But then you say, okay, there's 31 pairs, and they all do the same thing. So we've got these nerve branches that crisscross like this, and that's what we end up having is all these nerve branches that ultimately can crisscross and form a plexus, which is kind of where we're going to be where we're heading with this. To keep this clean and simple, I would know that a ramus is a branch of a spinal nerve. So a ramus is simply a branch of a spinal nerve. This gets messy really quick, doesn't it? Okay, so the reason I want this to look kind of messy is, see where all these spinal nerves crisscross and branch? These are now forming a network, and alternate pathways are always great to have, right? If you damage one pathway, you've got another backup pathway to follow. So in the next page or so, we're going to talk about something called a plexus, and this crisscrossing network that you're starting to see develop here, that is a plexus. Thank you. So let me repeat. We've got spinal nerves that have a dorsal root right here. That's a dorsal root that carries sensory information into your spinal cord. And then down below, we've got a ventral root that carries motor information away. So when they pass together through the intervertebral foramen of your spine, they now are together, and they're now called a spinal nerve. So because they are together, we're going to say that they are a mixed nerve. The term mixed nerve means you've got both motor and sensory housed together. And immediately, upon emerging from your intervertebral foramen, they split up once again, but this time they're not separated into sensory and motor. Each of these rami that branch off are in fact mixed. What does that mean?
Motor and sensory.
Motor and sensory, right. You have a ventral ramus that heads toward the front side of your body, and a dorsal ramus or posterior ramus that heads where?
To the back, exactly.
So if you think about all 31 pairs following the same pattern, they're bound to crisscross and run into each other. And when they crisscross and form networks, each rami forms a
plexus.
Good. So, sure.
Okay. So, in the ventral root, you have motor neurons carrying information to
and the,
away from.
Yeah.
And then the dorsal root, you have the sensory neurons carrying information away.
Toward.
Okay, so when they cross, that forms a mixed nerve in the intervertebral foramen.
Correct, that's right.
But then they split off and form ramus.
That's right.
So my question is, if you have, is the information that's going to the dorsal root mixed in that rami that forms a plexus, or does it continue going toward the dorsal root?
Let's say that this comes around here to your back. Let's say a bee stings you in your back. That bee sting pain comes in your dorsal ramus all the way in, and then it comes through the spinal nerve here that's combined. And it comes all the way in this way. So there's actually, it's like two different pathways, one going to your spinal cord and one coming from your spinal cord carrying motor information. So there's actually a two-way pathway of neurons inside that.
Going different directions, but doing the same thing?
Going in different directions, but have the same destination.
Oh, okay.
So if a bee stings you in your latissimus dorsi, that is sensory information coming to your spinal cord.
Right.
But then if you, you know, do arm adduction or whatever, then you now have motor information.
Coming from.
So it comes out this dorsal root here through this area, and then it splits and heads on its way.
Okay.
So did that kind of help?
Yeah, I just had a picture in my head because I saw way too many nerves doing too many things.
And it really is way too many nerves doing too many things when you're thinking about a plexus. And that's the goal.
You on the right track. You was able to say all that.
Because I was picturing it while she was saying it. So I was trying to make sure I pictured it right.
You got it pictured right.
Okay.
Yeah, you're good. So this picture may help too. You've got right there in the very center of the spinal cord. It's really hard to see the roots coming off, but there's your intervertebral foramen and the spinal nerve emerging, and immediately it splits into a dorsal ramus to your back muscles,
right.
And there's your ventral ramus coming all the way around to your sternum. Yep. I have them pictured as streets. That may help too, because if I think about this as a one-way street, and that's a one-way street, and these are highways that have lanes going in both directions.
Okay.
Bottom of your page is something called a dermatome map. This is really cool stuff. It's not cool if you've had the chicken pox, though. Anybody ever had the chicken pox?
I did.
Yeah.
I had shingles, so.
Ooh. If you've had either chicken pox or shingles or any kind of virus that likes to inflame spinal nerves or cranial nerves, then this directly relates to those disease processes. What you're looking at is a map of the dermatome, and basically it's the spinal nerves and the regions of the body they serve. They're color-coded here because you'll notice the head is served by a set of cranial nerves. This greenish color is cervical nerves, and then we got thoracics, and then lumbars and sacral nerves that serve the legs. So if you happen to have, say, a virus like this one shown here, this is shingles, then based on its location in your body, we can actually estimate which spinal nerve has been inflamed. And unfortunately, it causes a lot of painful blistering. You have to wait for the nerve inflammation to heal for that to go away. But it's interesting in that we can follow the dermatome map to where that particular spinal nerve goes. Now let me go back to this picture here. If you inflame a nerve, you're coming away from the spinal cord and you're gonna follow the nerve all the way around to the front side. You're never gonna actually start at the front and travel to the back side, nor are you gonna start on the back side and wrap your body all the way around. The inflammation has to start at your spinal cord, and then it travels like a hug from behind to meet at your midline on the front side, because that's the way these nerves work. If you're gonna have one on this side, it has to wrap from the other side and meet here at the midline. Okay, does that make sense? So these pictures are all of spinal nerve inflammations, chicken pox. Herpes does the very same thing. It follows a spinal nerve. And again, this is a spine back here, and you can see the inflammation starts at the spine and then travels to the front side of the body. You can see in this picture, the inflammation is more or less contained on one side of the face. Look at that, it stops right there at the midline. So that's why if you're, you know, the dentist office and you have a drilling on one side and they deaden you with some like lidocaine or whatnot, it only travels to the midline because that's where the nerve goes, and it doesn't travel across to the other side except in one of the jaws. And this is really cool. Look at that tongue. It is absolutely a straight line down the middle. That's because that cranial nerve is inflamed only on that side and the other side is not inflamed. Okay. So that takes us full circle. We're back to the plexus. This sounds like a good time to take a break, though. Why don't we come back about 9:10, and we'll then work on wrapping up the spinal nerve information. Okay, so we're back to talking about a plexus one more time. So each of these are spinal nerves. In fact, these are all lumbar spinal nerves. You can see that when they come out, they do branch, and all of these branches end up crisscrossing, forming a network of spinal nerves. And this kind of gives us a backup plan in case we have one route that may be damaged. We do have another route that can carry nerve impulses. There's actually five important nerve plexuses that I'd like to cover with you. They're on page 108. And the take-home message about them is you want to know what region they serve and the bold-faced important spinal nerve. So our first one is called the cervical plexus, and like the name implies, where is the cervical region?
In your neck.
In your neck, good. And you'll notice that this particular plexus has an important member known as the phrenic nerve. The phrenic nerve is important because it helps to regulate breathing. This particular nerve travels down each side of your neck. It stimulates your diaphragm and intercostal muscles to promote inhalation. So if that phrenic nerve connection is broken, then we have no way to breathe in unless we're mechanically assisted. So cervical plexus serves the neck, the phrenic nerve is the important member here. Our next important plexus is known as the brachial plexus. What body region does it serve? Good. Arm and hand, good. So we've got five important spinal nerves here, and you'll notice that they are musculocutaneous, which makes sense because it serves the muscles and what?
Hands.
Musculocutaneous serves muscles and? What is cutaneous?
Skin.
Yeah, that's good. Okay. Okay, and then median, you'll notice in this hand is color-coded as yellow. There's also an ulnar nerve. Which side of your arm should it be located on?
Pinky.
Pinky side. Good. And like we expect, it does serve the pinky side here. Thumb side is served by the radial nerve. And of course, there is one last one there. Axillary, found where?
Deltoid,
yeah. Kind of in the armpit, actually. So people who have carpal tunnel syndrome may in fact have the fascia around those particular nerves that is tightening, and if that tightens, then it causes nerve inflammation and it may cause numbness or pain in the hand. So we can tell which nerves are being inflamed by knowing which of these fingers or thumb may be affected. This is axillary damage. You'll notice the arm on the left cannot be raised above. Yeah, so that's a brachial nerve plexus injury, most likely something to do with that axillary nerve in the armpit region. Let's see, we've got next two leg ones. We've got lumbar and sacral. Which one of these serves the backside of your legs?
Sacral.
Good. Yes. You want to know an easy way to remember it? You sit on your sacral plexus. So S for S. Okay. Lumbar's on the front side. Sacral's on the back side. You sit on your sacral plexus. The important nerve in the lumbar plexus is the femoral nerve. It runs down the front of your leg. It does split about around the area of the knee and runs down to the foot. But it's that sacral nerve plexus on the back side that causes us so many problems. The sacral plexus has a special nerve called the sciatic nerve. And in this picture, you can see how it travels through a piece of your obturator foramen. It hides up underneath a little tiny muscle called the piriformis muscle, and then here it goes down the back side of your leg. If that piriformis muscle squeezes your sciatic nerve, now what you got?
Pain.
Pain, yeah. All the way down the back of your leg. And it may not feel like pain in the butt, which is where it originates. It may feel like pain in your foot or on the calf, but ultimately it probably originates back up here at that portion where it branches off the sacral nerve plexus. So that is really an interesting nerve. It is the longest nerve in the body, and it does serve the back of your leg all the way down there to your foot. So people who have like foot issues, like pain or numbness in the foot, we don't necessarily look there. We look for the pain in the butt that comes from the squeezing of that sciatic nerve. So. Oh, yeah, pregnant puts a lot of pressure on that, yeah. And sometimes that never goes away. Yep. Yep. For many years. There you can see. Any of you going into PTA? Okay, so one of your jobs may be to massage somebody's rear to get that piriformis muscle to relax and not squeeze around that sciatic nerve. Solar plexus is an interesting one. This one is found underneath your diaphragm, and it serves your abdominopelvic cavity. Specifically, it serves your digestive organs. So the solar plexus is actually an internal nerve plexus. You'll notice the two important members in this group are called splanchnic nerves and the vagus nerve. The splanchnic nerves serve your rectum. They help control bowel movements. And the vagus nerve is the wanderer. Which cranial nerve is that?
10.
Good. That's cranial nerve 10. And it's a special cranial nerve because it doesn't necessarily serve the cranium. It wanders away and serves the rest of your body. So cranial nerve 10, the vagus nerve, serves heart. It serves digestive organs. This particular nerve is important because it influences a lot of our involuntary activities. All right. So for those plexuses, what you'll want to know is the body region that they serve and the bold-faced important nerves. So I may say to you, okay, what does the sciatic nerve belong to? You'd say sacral plexus. Good. So we've actually talked about reflexes. To start off with, reflexes are rapid, predictable, automatic and involuntary responses to a stimulus. Okay, so they're rapid, predictable, automatic, and involuntary. Does that mean that you can make a reflex happen? You can't, right? So, you know, if you want to reflexively do something, it's something you have to train yourself to do. So one of the few things that you can train yourself to do is type. And of course, that involves a reflex that you eventually no longer think about. So when you're typing, you can process and do other things, and your fingers can still be moving on the keyboard. So kind of an interesting reflex that you can actually learn. Most of our reflexes are not learned. They're things like kicking your knee when we strike the patellar ligament, blinking's a reflex, withdrawing your hand or foot from a painful stimulus. These are all reflexes that are not learned. So most of our reflexes that involve from the neck down do not involve your brain. So how does the reflex work if it doesn't involve your brain? Spinal cord, yeah. So it involves your spinal cord. So your spinal cord is pre-wired and pre-routed to do these reflexes. So let's start off with a couple of the examples that we're going to work through. Let's talk about polysynaptic reflexes and monosynaptic reflexes. So to start with, what does poly indicate to us?
Many.
Good. And polysynaptic means many?
Synapses.
Good. And a monosynaptic reflex involves how many synapses?
One.
Just one. Good. So in this picture, we are looking at placing your hand on a sharp object like a tack. That sensory neuron in your dorsal root brings the information in. Notice that we make a stop here at your interneuron in the dorsal horn. That dorsal horn contains interneurons that communicate between sensory and motor neurons. So the reflex comes this way. It comes right down here to one of these ventral horn skeletal muscle motor neurons, and we come right back out that ventral root. What do we tell your skeletal muscles to do that's being poked by that sharp tack?
Pull away.
Pull away. Good. Why do you consider this one to be polysynaptic?
You got it.
Two neurons here, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, so count the synapses with me. There's a synapse right there, right?
Yeah.
Okay, this is a sensory one coming in. There's a motor neuron there. And of course, we synapse a second time here. Hey, that's all it takes, right, to be poly is two or more. So this qualifies as a polysynaptic reflex because you have at least two neurons involved, or actually three total, two synapses involved. So on the polysynaptic column, you'll notice that this is what we call a flexor reflex, otherwise known simply as a withdrawal reflex. Notice we didn't involve the brain for this. All we had to do was route into your spinal cord and right back out. So your brain didn't make the decision. Your spinal cord made the decision. I do want to tell you, though, that this dorsal horn contains interneurons that communicate between incoming sensory and outgoing motor. But this sensory neuron is also going to send information across the gray commissure up an ascending tract. And because we're talking about pain information, are we heading to the thalamus or to the cerebellum?
Thalamus,
good.
So is that why you may feel the pain somewhere though?
That would be referred pain from one of these plexuses crisscrossing and sending incorrect information. So normally if it's a pinprick or a bee sting, you're going to know pretty spot on where that is. Most of that referred pain is organ pain. So, yeah, if it's organ pain, you may not have a good feel for where it's coming from.
But is that problem going to cause cancer? How does that affect? Does it affect the
side? That's contralateral control. So if there's massive damage being done on this side, you can still get the message to the brain on the opposite side of the spinal cord. So it's kind of a self-preservation mechanism to have it doing contralateral control.
Back up,
yeah. Are
the crisscrosses the same thing?
Like this stuff here coming across, or
like
this crisscrossing. It might in fact be the reason, because if one nerve is inflamed, then the others may be inflamed. So yeah, you might get more inflammation there. And inflammation loves a party, so it brings more healing agents in. That may spread. Yeah. Okay. So we've taken care of one type of polysynaptic reflex. Let's just review the types of reflexes. Polysynaptics have many synapses. These reflexes include sensory, interneurons, and motor neurons. Monosynaptic reflexes are very simple. There is no interneuron here. All you do is simply have a sensory neuron communicate directly with an outgoing motor neuron. Which one of these do you think is the absolute fastest reflex?
Mono.
Yeah. So both are fast, but the most quickest of those two types is a monosynaptic reflex. Just checking to see if anybody needs a slide.
Yes.
Good. Anybody else need it? Good. Okay. So let's kind of talk about a monosynaptic pathway, because this is a very simple path. This reflex involves only a sensory neuron and a motor neuron. What type of neuron do we not involve in a monosynaptic reflex?
Interneuron.
Good. And we also don't involve the brain. This reflex goes into your spinal cord and comes right back out. So here we go. We've got a pathway of a sensory neuron. Notice we don't stop at the dorsal horn. We travel directly to the motor neuron, and that reflex goes right back out to the effector organ, whether it's a muscle or a gland. Notice, because this is a monosynaptic reflex, we should see how many synapses?
One.
Just one. And there it is, right there between that sensory and motor neuron. Now, this particular type of reflex is called a stretch reflex. If you overstretch your muscles, the possibility for tearing is a great one. So what happens is we have a reflex that tells the muscle to contract. If you've ever been laying in bed and pointing your toes and stretching, you ever get a Charlie horse?
Yes.
That's this, okay? So you stretch to the point that your muscles think they might tear. The reflex pops into the spinal cord, right back out. The muscle contracts just as hard as you were stretching, and boom, that muscle contracts on you. That does hurt. That's awful.
Yes.
Here's another monosynaptic reflex. This is the knee-jerk reflex. We've often heard that knee-jerk responses are fast, and of course, being monosynaptic, sure, it's a fast reflex. If you strike the patellar ligament around your knee, then your knee will automatically extend your lower leg, and that's because we've hit this reflex pathway. So here we go. We're going to follow this particular blue sensory neuron. It comes right here to this motor neuron. That comes back out to your quadriceps muscles. What is the function of your quads?
Extend the leg.
Extend the leg, exactly. So that's what happens through a patellar reflex or a knee-jerk reflex. This monosynaptic pathway encourages flexion, or rather extension, of the leg. In terms of polysynaptic pathways, we're looking at multiple neurons involved. In times where there's a flexor reflex or withdrawal reflex, we may see multiples. In fact, that's a pretty complicated pathway that you see there. So putting our hand on a hot stove, in fact, is a withdrawal reflex pathway. And of course, as always, we do a contralateral control, and we send that information to the brain as a courtesy. One last polysynaptic pathway is this one. If you've ever carried boxes for a friend or moved yourself, you notice that sometimes the box is so heavy that you no longer can hold it. You've probably been walking and going, I'm going to drop this, I'm going to drop this, and then eventually you come true and do drop it. What's happening is you're putting such tension on those muscles that you could potentially tear that tendon away from the attachment to the bone. So that, unfortunately, could cause major muscle damage that is beyond repair, may require surgery. So in this case, the reflex is to relax the muscle. This sounds opposite to the stretch reflex, doesn't it? An overcontracted muscle or one that's being too tired will eventually relax. The stretch reflex we just talked about, what happens there?
Contract,
right. So those two are kind of opposite reflexes. Let me make sure you got your blanks there for the reflex arc pathways about midway of your page. All of these reflex arc pathways bypass the brain. So these spinal nerve reflexes don't need the brain for decisions to be made. And the second question says, what part of the polysynaptic pathway is missing for a monosynaptic pathway? Yeah, no interneuron, good. Okay, so we're going to kind of shift gears. We've talked about the spinal cord and spinal nerves. Now we're going to shift gears and talk about the brain. We are still operating in the central nervous system. We're not going to cover the cranial nerves here in lecture, but you do those in lab. So, of course, they'll be covered this week because I know you guys got a lab test coming up soon. Let's talk about the brain. It has a similar set of coverings as your spinal cord. We've got bone, of course, the skull, in this case covering the brain, and we also have the same three meninges or membrane layers. What is the outermost covering of the brain called in terms of the meninges?
Dura
mater, good. And underneath that?
Arachnoid.
Impia mater, good. And which of those three layers is cerebrospinal fluid circulating?
Arachnoid,
good. Okay. So we talked in here, I believe it was last Wednesday, about these dura mater folds around the brain. There is a fold of dura mater that goes in between your two cerebral hemispheres. That crack between your two cerebral hemispheres is called the longitudinal fissure. There's a large vein that's found in that dura mater fold, and we call that superior sagittal sinus. There's also a fold of dura mater found between your cerebrum and cerebellum. This one runs horizontally, and we call it the transverse fissure. Likewise, the vessel laying in that fissure is called the transverse sinus. Good. So I kind of made the joke last week that these folds of dura mater are like wedgies. They do poke into the cracks between these parts of our brain, and they make a really nice place for a blood vessel to be located. Near the bottom of your page, we've got the cerebrospinal fluid circulation pattern. So I'd like to talk to you about what that CSF actually is. All right, so the issue is we don't necessarily want everything that's in your bloodstream to make contact with your brain tissue. Do you see anything that potentially could be harmful in your bloodstream that could get into your brain?
Bacteria.
Virus, exactly. And if it gets into your brain, then that could kill us, right? So what our brains do is our brains say, you know what? Don't let everything in the bloodstream contact the brain tissue. Only let the good stuff, the stuff that we need, contact the brain tissue. So what you're looking at are ventricles inside the brain. This is where the cerebrospinal fluid circulates. This is the good stuff that you want to have contacting your brain tissue. Our goal is to keep the potentially harmful stuff, like that bacteria or viruses, away from your brain tissue. So this cerebrospinal fluid that's going to be circulating throughout your brain is actually part of the blood. So I know this is going back into your histology studies. What are the two major components of your blood?
Plasma
and blood cells. Good. What type of blood cell transports oxygen?
Red blood cells,
good. So oxygen is important, nutrients are important, and the electrolytes found in your blood plasma are important. And that is exactly what we want to reach the brain tissue. We call this stuff cerebrospinal fluid, and we're going to squeeze this good stuff out of your blood and allow it to circulate as cerebrospinal fluid around your brain and your spinal cord. This is a capillary, and the capillary is surrounded by ependymal cells. You'll notice those ependymal cells have cilia. So we're going to put the squeeze on this capillary, and we're going to squeeze out the good stuff, the nutrients, the oxygen. We're going to let it diffuse out, vitamins, electrolytes. And these fluid-containing riches are going to be pushed across the wall of the capillary and captured in cerebrospinal fluid. So big picture here, there is a choroid plexus where we do the squeeze on the capillaries down here by your cerebellum. There's another one here by your lateral ventricles. So this is where we're squeezing the blood plasma out of your bloodstream and forcing that plasma to circulate as cerebrospinal fluid. Are you with me so far? Okay. So when we squeeze CSF out of your bloodstream, let's take it on a tour. I'm going to pick this set of capillaries and this choroid plexus here to be our starting point. Let's take a look at this picture on the front-on view of the brain. We are actually sitting in choroid plexuses that feed cerebrospinal fluid into these two lateral ventricles on each side of your brain. So that fluid circulates like horns into our two cerebral hemispheres. It travels down through a small opening here called the interventricular foramen. How do you know it's a hole?
Foramen,
good. And interventricular tells you where it's between the two ventricles. Good, the two that curl into the sides of your brain. Let's travel down. We are now in the third ventricle between your two hemispheres. Travel on further down. You're in the cerebral aqueduct. Very tight passageway. And then now you're in this baseball diamond-shaped area called the fourth ventricle. In this picture here, let's get you a different view. That little region in here is what we call the fourth ventricle. So you can kind of get a feel for where we're located. Right here, that's fourth ventricle. Looks like a V.
Okay,
and so here we are. That is the fourth ventricle. You get it from both sides. So let's start it from the top. We make cerebrospinal fluid in an area called the choroid plexus. It's a little knot of capillaries, and we give the squeeze to the capillaries and force out the blood plasma. We let the fluid travel through the two lateral ventricles. We leak down through an opening called the interventricular foramen, now into the third ventricle, through a very tight passageway called the cerebral aqueduct, and into this big baseball diamond called the fourth ventricle. Keep on traveling down. We're now in the central canal of your spinal cord. And we're going to come to this picture because you're going to watch it come all the way to the bottom of your spinal cord. Where does your spinal cord technically end? Lumbar is around L1, L2. Yeah, so around the waist area is where we end with the spinal cord. And now that cerebrospinal fluid drips off the end and is in your subarachnoid space. So we've got dura matter, arachnoid matter, and pia matter. We're in that arachnoid matter outside the spinal cord. That CSF flows outside your spinal cord. It flows outside your brain, and eventually it gets reabsorbed back into one of those great big veins we call a sinus. We call them dural sinuses because they lay in the dura matter around your brain. This little pocket right here is called an arachnoid granulation or an arachnoid villus, and that's where the cerebrospinal fluid gets pulled back into the vein. Veins take blood back to your heart, and then it rejoins blood flow. So that's the pathway of cerebrospinal fluid. It's written for you over on page 111. I know that is one of your lab test questions on test number 4 in lab, and I'm going to put that as a bonus for you guys on this test. Okay. Yep, so that'll be a 3-point bonus on our test. I can't because it's in those curled ventricles, but if you take a look at this picture, you're just going down. Imagine. often with this, unfortunately. Most of them I could draw, but not this one. Say that again. It's a three-point tracing, so it's three bonus points if you choose to do this one. There's another bonus in there, so you can have a 1 and 4. Yeah. Let me give you a heads up. If you haven't yet learned this tracing, I encourage you to sit with a picture like this one. This is a great picture. And you may realize that if you start at the top of the lateral intervals, you're just coming down.
But this makes it make more sense versus just looking at the diagram or looking at it on a piece of paper.
Yeah. And you guys notice there's no first or second ventricle, right?
Mm-hmm. Sorry. You go with lateral then third.
Lateral then third, yeah. So it's a ventricle, something, a ventricle, something, another ventricle, and then you're another something. Yeah, so it's ventricles alternating with another structure. It's not bad. Use the picture, and I think you'll get it really quick with the picture.
This bonus is like writing it out, or you got like a multiple choice?
It's writing it out, okay. So you'll start on 111 with choroid plexus and take me back in at the arachnoid villi for dural sinuses. Yeah. How about questions on CSF flow?
It's kind of similar to the kidneys, the glomerulus.
Yeah, you're right, because of the filtration aspect.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what we're doing in 211 right now, so. So when we want to sample cerebrospinal fluid, an easy way to do it is, well, I don't know if it's easy, but a way to do it is to go through the cartilage between your vertebrae and not penetrate into the spinal cord, because that could cause spinal nerve damage or nerve damage up and down that spinal cord. We only want to hit that subarachnoid space and sample out a piece of that CSF flow. So lumbar taps and epidurals work in a similar fashion, that we're accessing the same portion around your spinal cord. In the case of an epidural, we're placing medications into the spinal cord or in the space around it rather than sampling out the fluids flowing there. I did want to show you this picture. This is excess cerebrospinal fluid. Only babies under age 1 would have their head swell like this. After age 1, what happens to your skull sutures? They close, yeah. So this baby's actually fortunate. I know he doesn't look very fortunate in this picture, but because his head can swell, it doesn't crush his brain tissue. After age 1, because our skull sutures are more fused, unfortunately, that much excess fluid could cause a cramp on your brain and actually flood your brain like you see in the picture on the right. That can cause permanent and irreversible brain damage. So what we should be seeing are the lateral ventricles right there, this diamond-shaped baseball fourth ventricle here in the middle. Notice that's all become flooded with excess cerebrospinal fluid. So when you push the brain against the skull, like you see in this picture, it's like bruising a peach. You know, if you bruise the skin around the peach, it damages it and you've got that brown spot. Kind of does the same thing to our brains. If you bruise the outermost portion, that's where your conscious thought and personality come from, and that's irreversible damage. So those conditions, by the way, are hydrocephaly. And nowadays we know how to treat it. We can get a pump installed and actually pump off that excess fluid so that way we don't have it built up around the brain. What's that? It's a shunt, yeah. And it's a pump that will move it off so we don't get too much.
But don't they have to go through multiple surgeries? Because
they
grow.
Replacing the shunt, right?
They might have to replace,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because if they grow.
Right, if they grow.
Move.
Right. And they have to make sure they're not taking too much fluid versus not enough fluid. Yeah. So the whole reason for having cerebrospinal fluid is because of this issue of a blood-brain barrier. The blood vessels that travel through your brain are actually sealed tight for the most part, except those at the choroid plexuses and at the hypothalamus and medulla oblongata. So the blood-brain barrier is a sealed tight set of vessels inside your brain This prevents things like bacteria and viruses from reaching your brain tissue, but it also prevents good stuff from reaching your brain, like medications as well. So thinking way back, what type of junction forms a good solid seal between neighboring cells? Bingo, tight junctions. So tight junctions help to form your blood-brain barrier. That prevents the passage of fluids between these capillaries and their cells. And then also we've got astrocytes, a type of neuroglial cell that's located here. They too help to contribute to the formation of this blood-brain barrier. So the blood-brain barrier is meant to provide a sealed, tight network of capillaries. The only things that can get through are things that can diffuse. That would be fatty-based substances and things like oxygen. Okay, so oxygen, carbon dioxide, fatty-based molecules. So otherwise, any fat can travel through a plasma membrane because of that phospholipid bilayer semi-permeable to them. That means that other water-based molecules can't travel across that semi-permeable membrane. So anything like a hormone like testosterone, estrogen, a medication that's fat encapsulated can reach the brain tissue, but everything else is barred from traveling. Okay, so that should cover you for page 111. How about questions there? Okay. In order to cover page 112 and 113, I'd like to one more time label a picture with you. And this one's found on page 115. If you want a head start for Wednesday, page 112 is a really good place to look. 113 has a chart on it. That's also a really good place to look. I know this is dark, but I want to help you label this thing. Okay. So first thing I need to help you do is orient yourself with this picture. And the way to do that is to look for the cerebellum. The cerebellum is always on the back side of your brain where your occipital lobe is found. And so that back portion is going to be our posterior side of the brain. I'm just going to put P back here for posterior. That makes this side over here the anterior side of your brain. Let's start by labeling the lobes of the cerebrum. These correspond to the brain's, or rather the skull's bone names, so that makes it a pretty easy job. We know that this one here on the front is called what lobe?
Frontal
lobe, good. Let's see, where should we look for the, occipital lobe, let's do that one next.
Posterior,
good. All right, notice where I drew a white line and that crack in the brain.
Parietal.
That is the divider between parietal and
frontal.
Yeah, so that's what I needed to know was where that dividing point was.
Temporal,
good. So what you've got so far are the four lobes of the cerebrum. And just for frame of reference, let's label cerebellum at the back. And the crack. Yeah, transverse you can see here. Longitudinal is literally a part down the middle of the two cerebral hemispheres. So in this picture, we can't actually see the longitudinal. Okay, so let's go back to that white line. We've got separating parietal lobe from frontal lobe. That little that crack, let's just call it a crack, that's easier, right? It has a name, and because it's a groove down into your brain, we're going to call it a sulcus. Good. And its name is? You got it, central sulcus. If you're down in the dumps and you're sulking, right, sulcus is a down in the grooves. A gyrus, by the way, is a hill of brain tissue, and the whole reason for having these hills and valleys of brain tissue is to increase the surface area and processing power. So our brains have to fit inside our skulls, and our skulls have to fit through mother's birthing canal, and of course, that can be a very tight fit as it is, so we need all the help we can get in maximizing brain processing power, yet still being able to be birthed. So of course, having a big brain is something that we kind of pride ourselves on. We've got a lot of processing power that other animals don't have. I had a student several years ago come up with a catchy way to keep this straight. It may work for you. She said, God was up, Satan was down, G-S. And if you keep that in mind, there's your gyrus, and that groove down there is your sulcus. So sulk, or to be in the dumps, is in the sulcus region of your brain. So that's what we've got. There is a major sulcus separating parietal lobe from frontal lobe.
Question.
Sure.
How would you be able to label a prefrontal term and a postfrontal?
I'm taking you there. That's my very next step.
Oh.
Okay. So this piece of tissue on the front side right here and this piece of tissue on the back side is what we're looking at next. Keep in mind anterior from posterior. If you're in front of the central sulcus, you're in what's called the precentral gyrus region, that little white area right there. Guess where the postcentral gyrus is located?
Mm-hmm.
Behind. Good. So go behind your central sulcus. Okay. A couple of other things to add to our drawing here. On the far right side, you've got prefrontal cortex. So that must be in the frontal lobe. I'm just going to put a little dotted line around a portion of it, and we're going to call that prefrontal cortex. So your personality, decorum, knowing what to say it, when not to say it, is all housed there in that prefrontal cortex. Back in the 1940s to the 1960s, prefrontal lobotomies were performed for people that had bipolar disorder. And they thought that by jabbing out with something that looks almost like an ice pick, that prefrontal cortex, that would help solve bipolar disorder. And it took 20 years to stop this from happening. And unfortunately, people who had this prefrontal cortex damaged lost personality, decorum, knowing what to say, when to say it, and toilet training ability, because that's where all of this stuff is housed, in that prefrontal cortex. People who were hit, you know, from an accident or whatever in this prefrontal cortex region right here also have personality disorders, toilet training issues, decorum issues, not knowing what to say or when to say it. So all of that is prefrontal cortex housed. Let's see, our next thing on your list there is called the primary motor cortex. Primary indicates the first motor cortex. So when you decide to pick up your pen or pencil and write, those conscious thoughts have to come from the primary motor cortex. Do you know where it's housed?
No.
Frontal lobe.
On the precentral gyrus.
Good, precentral gyrus, good. So let's make a note that over here is where your primary motor cortex is housed.
Your head.
it's the precentral gyrus, which is white right there.
That area right there?
Yeah, in the frontal lobe.
Okay. We're
just doing an overview. Wednesday we come back and we do the details, so you're going to see this again on Wednesday. Conscious control of motor, yeah. Conscious skeletal motor control. Postcentral gyrus over here in the parietal lobe is actually home to our primary somatic sensory cortex. And boy, what a mouthful that is. But it has to do with your sensations. Like if you put your hand in your pocket and you feel coins and you can pull a quarter out without even looking, that is your primary somatic sensory cortex. Okay, so it's housed in your postcentral gyrus. All right, and that's on the back side of that central sulcus. All right, so a couple of last things here to wrap up our info. Let's just jot down that vision. Good, an occipital lobe.
And the auditory is under control.
Good, auditory or hearing. And temporal lobe.
Speech center is under control.
Yeah. And for most of us, the speech center is on the left side of your brain. Right, right. And we also have a general interpretive area. I'll show you that in a different picture, but for most of us, speech and general interpretation are found on the left side of your brain. Today was just an overview of the brain. What I'm going to do Wednesday is go back to the chart on 112 and 113 and fill in all of the details for you.